Welcome to the Narrators Podcast. I'm Robert Rutherford.
And I'm Andrew Orvidal. This podcast collects stories that were told at the Narrators, a monthly storytelling event that features people telling true stories based on a theme.
The show takes place on the third Wednesday of every month at the Buntport Theater in Denver, Colorado.
These stories were recorded live on August 20th, 2014. The theme of the evening was Lost. We'd like to give a special shout out to our newest sponsor, Breckenridge Brewery, who is now providing beer at our live show. Thanks, Breck. If you'd like to know more about Breckenridge Brewery, visit breckbrew.com. Enjoy these stories.
This next storyteller, he is the founder of one of the co-founders of the High Plains Comedy Festival. He is Andrew's partner in crime with the Grolix Comedy Group. And I am super excited to have him here because he hasn't done this show in a really, really long time. So the prodigal son has returned. So please give a round of applause for Adam Caton Holland.
How about that, Ron Doyle, huh? Doing a great job. Who's ready for another sad story? I got one. I'm going to read mine. This story is called Just Keep Moving. I was addicted to the show Man vs. Wild for a while. It's a survival show starring Bear Grylls, a British adventurer stud who gets dropped into insane remote locations and then, using nothing but what he has on him and his wits, survives for days at a time. I couldn't get enough of that show. Of course, later it was revealed that Bear was faking a lot of the stunts, that he would spend the night in a motel, or that a seemingly remote desert island was just a desolate part of the big island in Hawaii. But that didn't matter to me. I just loved the show. Plus, there was no faking the stunts he pulled off. I saw that guy drink liquid drained from elephant dung to avoid dehydration in the middle of the savannah. Staged or no, Bear Grylls was going to the limits to teach you about survival, to teach you what to do when you became truly lost. I remember his mantra in that show, just keep moving. He said it every episode, when all the odds are stacked against you, when it seems as if you're not going to make it, when you're completely and utterly lost out there, you just keep moving. It makes sense. When you're out of your element, away from normal circumstances and surroundings, you need something to focus your mind on, to keep you from panicking, to keep you from flipping out. That simple act of a desperate human to keep moving is the human's only hope for survival. It's a middle finger to being lost. Yeah, maybe it's a willful rejection of the reality of the situation, a refusal to admit the truth even, but fuck it, this is about life and death. You want to keep living? Keep moving. Plain and simple. So that's what I do. I've been doing it for a little over 2 years now. It's the only thing I can do, because when I stop and slow down and admit how lost I really am, it's like staring into the abyss. It's total, and it's all-encompassing, and it's so dark, and so easy to get swallowed by. Honestly, though, sometimes I do stop moving. But I don't beat myself up about it. I bet Bear did that, too. On some long, scary nights, back before the cameras started rolling, on some insane adventurer's trek to the Himalayas or Kilimanjaro, where things got terrifying and desperate and he couldn't help but think about how fucked he really was, how unfair these new circumstances were, I bet he broke down. So I let myself do it, too. Occasionally, I'll allow myself to really internalize how lost I am, to really tap into it and feel it, and it's terrifying and overwhelming, and I break down for a little bit, but then I dust myself off, I pull myself up by my emotional bootstraps, and I just keep moving, because you have to. Otherwise, you'll wind up in the psych ward, like my little sister did. It's funny how when you look back on things, the moment right before you became so lost is the moment you felt so found. Or if not funny, tragic. I wonder if it's that way for everyone. It certainly was for me. In July of 2012, I was invited to be a new face at the Montreal Just for Laughs Comedy Festival. It was and is a big deal. It's like being drafted as a professional athlete. The big leagues have called you up. They have noticed what you're doing, and they like what they see, and they want to invite you to the show, kid. You ready for the show? For a comic, it's a dream come true, and for me, it was the culmination of a lot of hard work. Being a stand-up comic is hard work anywhere, but doing it from Denver is harder than a lot of places. To get recognized by the powers that be from such an obscure, not New York or Los Angeles kind of town is an accomplishment, an achievement even, and I was proud of it. It felt like things were finally working out. I performed great. Crushed is the parlance we use here in the biz. I got a lot of press, got signed to a fancy agency, and I decided that I would move to Los Angeles now, to go for it. After years of meandering, after years of figuring out the path I wanted to be on, I felt like I was finally on it. I felt like I was finding myself, like I was starting to be found. And then I got lost. I got off the plane from Canada to a message from a friend that my little sister had acted insane while I was gone. Unfortunately, that had become all too common in the recent months. She had made a seat in a bar. The details are unimportant. But a friend felt concerned enough to call me, and so I called my sister, and she collapsed into hysterics. And I went and picked her up, and I tried to talk to her. She'd gone to the psych ward a month prior, overdosed on pills. I carried her into the hospital myself. And she had swore it wasn't intentional. She was just trying to sleep. And for some reason, we believed her. We didn't know better. This had never happened before. She had never gone so far down the rabbit hole. This was Lydia, our Lydia, my little sister, the funniest girl I ever met. We believed her, trusted her, and loved her. She bounced back from that experience and seemed to be earnestly trying to make herself better, taking new medications, going to yoga classes, hiking, trying to find peace. We had no idea she was keeping such a dark secret. She promised us she was not. We asked her directly. I remember how lost she seemed that day after I came back from Montreal. I picked her up to take her out for breakfast, and we drove by an Ethiopian church, and the entire congregation was exiting out onto the steps in front. Worshippers spilling out of a sermon, the women dressed all in white, some of the men wearing beautiful headpieces that were strange and exotic looking. And I remember telling Lydia to look at that scene, to take it in. I know nothing about their religion, I told her. I don't know what they're wearing that stuff for. I don't understand the significance, but just look at how beautiful they look. This group of strangers who, for whatever reason, are displaced some 5,000 miles from their home on the high steppe of Denver, worshiping the same way that they did back in their homeland. I tried to remind her that, all in all, the world is a beautiful place, full of mystery and treasures and adventures, full of people and communities and revelations that we aren't even aware of, so why get so bogged down in our own bullshit? She humored me, smiled weakly, but she was defeated. Her mental illness was winning completely. Those Ethiopian worshippers didn't matter to her. She could barely see them. She couldn't see beyond what was plaguing her. She was just too lost. We got waffles with peanut butter and Nutella on them, and then I dropped her off back at her house. That was the last time I ever saw my little sister alive. So now I just keep moving. It's the only thing I can do. I've had 3 significant breakdowns since Lydia died, one just the other day. And every time I do, I'm responsible about it. I honor those feelings. I allow myself to mourn. I go to therapy, more than anyone really knows. But then I allow myself to move on, because that shit is so all-encompassing, so profoundly and totally soul-devouring, an anguish that literally makes it hard to breathe, that you have to pull out of it. You can't allow yourself to feel it for too long. You can call that denial if you want. You can call that blocking it out. But I think anyone who has lost someone close to them knows that anguish and the danger of feeling it too deeply, too often. It's so easy to tap into, but buyer fucking beware. Because once you tap into it, it's not so easy to pull back out. It swallows you, the darkness. And then you realize how lost you are. Yeah, there's a freedom in that too, letting go, surrendering to it, the nihilism. But then 3 days have gone by and you've forgotten to eat and you're like, oh yeah, I'm lost. Time to keep moving. I don't want to stay lost. People have commented to me about all that I've accomplished in the 2 years since my little sister Lydia died. Like it's really lit a fire under my ass. Convinced me of my own mortality or something. Motivated me to start achieving things that I've always wanted to do. I thank them for the kind words, but I know I have no other choice. Once one task is finished, the next must be begun. No time to sit. No time to wallow in it. Staying put is giving in. It's admitting that you're lost, and I'm not going to admit that. I can't, because if I do, I'll worry I'll be lost forever. So I keep moving. I move past the sad glances and whispers about what happened to me. I move past the conversations with friends who say, if you ever need to talk about it, we're here. And so you start to talk about it, and they remind you, okay, man, well, if you ever need to talk about it, we're here. Isn't that what I was just trying to do? Should I set up an appointment? It's not their fault. It's awkward. They don't know what to do, what to say. Nobody does. So you keep moving. I move past my mother not recovering. I move past my dad overcompensating. I move past my sisters and my own drunken breakdowns. I just keep moving. I move past the concern that there's something in my DNA that is predisposed to this. The handful of relatives that have chosen to end their lives this way too. The feelings that it would be reckless of me to pass on these corrupted genes. They would be wrong of me to start a family because the well is poisoned. I move past those feelings. I move from stage to stage to tell jokes to strangers. I keep moving through long articles I write trying to tell the world about my little sister. I move past the concerns that I'm being exploitative of my own sadness, milking it for attention or popularity, because I know how much people eat this shit up, how much people like to assign the darkness to the comedian. Robin Williams, much anyone? I move past the feeling that by bringing it into what I do, into my writings and musings, I'm capitalizing on all of it in some way. Because lately I've started to not care when or where is the proper forum to express my feelings of grief and remorse and just plain heartache because I miss my little sister so bad. Does it make you uncomfortable? My apologies, but I don't really fucking care. This isn't about you. This is about me and my sister and my survival. I'm figuring this shit out as I go, and I'm going with everything I got because going helps me feel like a sane person. Going helps me not dwell on things. Yeah, I stop and tap into it every now and again, but those moments are getting farther and farther apart. Because when you're lost, there's nothing more foolish than lamenting how lost you are. Just ask Bear Grylls. That's the quickest and easiest way to die. And I'm trying to live, to be found. So I put my best foot forward every day that I find myself able to. I push things down deep inside of me every day, and I pray they don't boil over and explode. I just keep moving. Thank you.
We have, for our final story, we have two, double your pleasure, two storytellers. These gentlemen are in town from Los Angeles by way of Boston for the High Plains Comedy Festival. These two comedians are, we love them. We love them. They're great. They've done this. They've done the show before, and we're really excited to have them back again. Please welcome Dave and Chris, the Walsh Brothers.
How about another round of applause for everybody you've seen tonight? Adam.
That's right. Mary. Great storytelling.
So at some point in our story, you're going to detect a hint of an accent from us.
That's right.
That's because my brother and I, we were born and raised in the movie The Town.
We come from the town, the town.
The town.
Ben Affleck directed our upbringing.
That is a lie. So the name of that town is Charlestown, Massachusetts. It's a square mile. It's where the Battle of Bunker Hill was fought. It's where the USS Constitution, Old Ironsides, resides.
Still resides.
Yes. And we are from there, and our story isn't... A lot of kids...
One of the things you need to know about our town is growing up, it had the highest unsolved crime rate in the world in like the 1980s.
Murder.
Murder rate, which is, you know, worse than just the crime rate, I'd say.
Every other crime they could solve, really, like yeah, that, yeah, but murder like, for
oh,
some reason.
I did it. People would just volunteer themselves. Yeah. But murder, everyone got away with it.
Manslaughter, they'd line up at the police.
And what generally would happen is somebody would get, like, shot in a bar or shot on the street, and there would be, like, a, you know, the whole town would see it or the whole town would know, and nobody would say a thing.
It's called Code of Silence. I've been trying to make a movie about it for a long time now.
Usually just terrible movies.
Yeah. And by the way, when people find out we're from Charleston, like if people really like that where you're from, how they're depicted in the movies, and we're always like, they got it right. A lot of pieces of shit where we're from. and it comes from
people.
A place of poverty, a lot of poor people. In this square mile, there are three sets of projects, and...
You know, a lot of people would hand down, say, like bank robbery as a craft, like a father would teach his son or he'd bring him in on a job. I mean, it's funny, but it's actually mostly true. I mean, kids that when we
so
were
So we had
up,
two parents. We had two parents who were there for us the whole time.
We
a lot of kids
lucky.
Grew up with no parents.
Neither of them bank robbers.
And because of the town where it resides, such a lovely part of Boston, we never felt the need to leave the house. And for a long time, our parents, they still live with us. And
which was pathetic. They're in their 50s. I mean,
and everything. Yeah.
Get out and get a job, Mom.
Right.
They're hiring everywhere.
So my
get out and shovel for Christ's sake.
Our older brother became a cop at some point, and he still didn't leave the house, which lent us.
It was like
the
a sitcom, you know. Our brother was a cop. Our
sister was pregnant,
nurse.
Not married.
Right.
And by Jesus, and then.
That's how it happens in an Irish Catholic family.
It lent the opportunity for a lot of comical situations for us. We would dress up in my brother's police uniforms and then just walk the streets in them.
Or drive around in our mother's Volkswagen, telling people to keep it moving.
Dressed as cops.
Nothing to see here.
Right.
All right.
And so,
you got any drugs on you? No? Yeah, give them to me.
A popular thing. And so one thing... When we started doing comedy, we started making videos. We had our own show and stuff. And we used to make these real-time videos where stuff would happen live.
Like, for instance, we would have a heckler in the audience. Someone would be heckling us the whole time. And everyone here would be like, shut the fuck up.
Right.
And then we would carry the guy out. And we filmed a video where we carried him out. Now, we had this, this myth, this sort of urban legend in our town of the clown.
The clown.
It was a guy who dressed up as a clown, and he drove around in a white van. Which, they could never find him for some reason.
But then you're not revealing what he did, supposedly. He would touch kids.
Right, he was a pedophile clown.
He was a pedophile kid-touching clown in a white van, and the cops could never catch him.
Right.
So this myth persisted, and we were and lived in fear of this thing.
You couldn't
even
just go, three blocks to the Boys and Girls Club without hiding under cars every time you thought you heard a white
clown
van coming.
The clown was our Iliad. That was our Iliad. We grew up with this, and meanwhile, just down the street, there were very real priests really touching
all
children.
The kids in
Nobody
Boston,
saying
all
a
kids.
Word
just
about this.
Now people are just, they're giving churches for their troubles.
So we lived in fear of this clown, so when we got older, we kind of capitalized on this, where we took this heckler and we ushered him into a van that our friend drove
in
honor of the clown.
Dressed as a clown, waiting in a van. So we filmed this video, and that night we were filming that video. We had
we were driving around the town.
Dressed as a clown.
In this white van.
With our friend stuffed in a trash bag, where we were filming
scenes. And a guy dressed
as
a clown.
Right.
And we had these lights. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. And so we're driving around for a while and eventually getting footage.
It's kind of one of those nights where you're maybe a little too drunk, you shouldn't be driving, or really high, and you're just driving around. You're like, I'll get high, there won't be any trouble. And then you see cops just everywhere you turn. You know what I mean? A cop goes by you. So we're in this van driving with the clown, and the cops drive directly by us. On a
they
very
look
small
at us
street.
In this window, and they
and
give
we
us
have
this.
A, we have lights on the clown. You know, we're trying to light him really nice, make him look creepy while he's driving around
from
in this
below.
Van,
has anyone ever taken a selfie from down
smart,
here?
You know?
Ooh,
and
not
then,
pretty.
And so we drive by our first cop of the evening, and my friend's
the
like,
the look on this cop's face.
Just like
he was so helpless. Like he looked at us.
Watch this clown drive. There he is. Been looking for this guy since the 70s. So.
And there he is, but
our friend,
he never stopped.
He never stopped,
the
just
cop
kept going.
Kept going.
We're like, this is the per... And our friend informed us at that point that he had had his license was revoked. He couldn't... And we were like, you should... That's not something you tell us as the first... as a cop drives by us.
But in all honesty, we didn't give a shit.
Right, we didn't care. On with the show.
We
got to get our scenes filmed.
We drive a little further, and then another cop flying by.
Like
the
further,
going.
Like 2 blocks. There's another cop. Charlestown's it's 1 square mile. It's tiny.
Eventually, 4 or 5 cops pass us, and we're wondering what the hell is going on. Where they don't want to even pull us over for curiosity's sake. So we get home that night, and later on that night, our brother gets in really late, and we are informed that there was a murder at a local bar. We have quite a few bars in our town. And we have 3 Sullys in our town.
Sullivans.
Yes. And none of them are owned by the same people.
Right. They're all
We have
named
a new
Sullivans.
Sullys, an old Sullys, and a regular Sullys.
Right.
And
so you got to clarify with people which Sullys you're going to be at.
You were drinking
Just regular Sullys.
So there was...
Regular Sullys.
So there was... Somebody got killed at Sullys.
Right.
And our brother came home, and it turns out that this kid we grew up with, who's named Kika, that's his name, killed somebody, stabbed him to death. So that's the end
if
of that.
If you used his regular name, you wouldn't. People would be like, who are you talking about?
Kika went and he hid, and he wasn't found for 3 days. And my brother was brought in. He was in the gang unit. It wasn't a gang issue, but because he grew up in the town, he knew everybody.
Knew where all the people would hide.
He kind of orchestrated this whole search to find this kid, who is our age, and we grew up with him. Went to camp with, and... Just a punk his whole life.
Right,
you know,
any person we grew up with.
8 years old, and then he just went in the other direction, and we went in the direction of Doritos and
the other direction. The other direction being prison.
Yeah.
So there's Doritos in prison.
And we still have an still have an element of mischief, right. But it kind of stops at killing people, I think.
We dress people up as clowns.
Right.
That's our mischief.
So he searches. So after 3 days, they find him hiding in a house, and they get him.
They take him
a year and a half later, a little backstory on me. A year and a half later, he was up for the case was
trial.
Happening.
Right.
I hadn't had to serve jury duty my adult life to this point because I had I was convicted of a crime myself.
He had a prior,
right,
as they say in Boston. He had a prior.
So I didn't have to.
You get some priors. Yeah. That's probably the best thing about having a prior is that you don't have to serve jury duty.
Right.
Everything else sucks. You can't get hired.
You don't have to listen to racist Boston people say, just go in and say something racist.
Right.
They'll just dismiss you right
away.
Just say
something racist, then they won't put you on jury duty.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. You can say a million things, but you got to be racist to get off? Is that right. How it works?
So the day I go in for jury duty, we got brought into a courtroom, and there is Kika.
Right.
Sitting in this court,
kid that we
I
grew up with,
somehow am
played football with
in the jury pool of this kid I grew up with. And I think this is great.
First case back.
Yeah, I'm
like a homicide detective who just came back from Barbados.
And I'm walking by and I'm trying to sneak past this kid. I don't want him to notice me, and he's just watching everybody like who's going to decide my fate. When in reality, he didn't give a shit. He's just looking at girls he wants to fuck.
He's just a horrible piece of shit.
Right. So. I'm walking by, and he's like, Walshy. Just starts saying, Walshy. And I'm like ignoring this guy with my Dean Koontz novel. And he's like.
Which one was
Twilight
it?
Eyes.
Oh,
it
no, Twilight Eyes.
Twilight
Eyes. That's
I was
our
reading
favorite.
It for the fourth
That's
time.
That's our favorite.
And I'm walking by, and he's like, Walshy. Walshy, what's up?
What's up, guy?
And
what's up, guy? How you
like,
been?
I was like, nothing, Kika. He's like, how you doing? I was like, a lot better than you, Kika. You have to be frank with these people.
Yeah. Jesus.
And he's like, yeah, well, how's your mother? I'm like, you don't even know my mother, Kika. Just shut the fuck up. Sit there. And everybody knew he did this thing.
It's a small town.
Right. Any people knew the person he killed, and nobody liked him for it. And then people were giving us trouble, like all the kids who... Our punks were giving our family a little bit of trouble because my brother
our
was
brother
the arresting
was,
officer.
Right.
So we sit.
And
I sit.
And also because those kids are pieces of shit.
I
don't know if I need to clarify that, but I thought I would.
Over off to the side, and they start listing.
Your brother's a cop guy? Fuck him. Oh, all right. Just, he's a good guy.
Maybe isn't.
Maybe.
Who knows?
Who knows?
They start announcing the case. The judge or the clerk starts saying what the case is. And at one point, they introduce the defendant. And they have the lawyer stand up, and he says, Your Honor, my client, Francis Lang. Now, this kid's
at
name,
this point,
I just said, was Francis Lang. Very few people,
Kika, who's sitting
even
here.
In our town, cousins of this of Kika, know that his name was Francis Lang. Everybody has given a nickname. Kika stuck.
It could be like the final Jeopardy question, and everybody in Charlestown would have gotten it wrong.
I didn't know that was his name. His name was Francis Lang. It doesn't even have an O before it. And so Kika was sitting there, who's very proud. Like, and essentially, the only thing this kid has is his name. So when he hears Francis Lang, he tugs on his attorney's
gives him a
blazer,
nice...
who leans over, who just had this look of... complete defeat, and he says, I'm sorry, Judge, my client, Francis Kika. He actually said, I screwed that up. He actually said Francis Kicker.
And he pronounced the ER.
Right, like any
which,
you know,
to which Kicker
educated
now
person
pulling
does.
Out his jacket again. Wanted him to get it right.
When he pronounced it Kicker, Kicker just leaned on his lapel again, and he pulled him down, and then the judge came back, and he's like, I'm sorry, Your Honor, Kika, my defendant, Kika. And Kika's sitting back like he just ate a million canaries, like he was the happiest, and feathers are just coming out of his mouth. He was so proud. Kika, there it is.
It's on the record.
That's it.
It's on the record.
Send me to jail now. So at some point, they start going through all the list of... people who you start after raising your hand for if you know any of the people involved in the case or what happened,
if
any information.
From Charlestown.
So does anybody know the first question? Anybody know the defendant? I raise my hand. Does anybody know the defendant's family? Raise my hand. Does anybody know the person who was killed?
Does anybody know an arresting officer?
So I raised my hand for like 31 out of the 35 questions. Officer?
Did anyone grow up with the defendant?
Right.
Play football with him?
Does anybody know what the defendant's fantasies right. are? And I was like, I felt like I was in the fourth grade, and I was.
You
got
to switch arms where you got to go to the bathroom, and the teacher's like working on a math problem on the board.
And so they're dismissing people around me constantly. Right. It's like, what do I got to do? Say something racist to get dismissed? From So eventually, they whittle it down. It's like they started with 100. Say there's 40 left. They start bringing you up. In front, now,
in front of the judge.
The cream of the crop. Like, right. I could be picked for this. I could send this guy away. Be splitting rocks in no time. So we have to wait two by two. They have this old Noah's Ark system in Boston Municipal Court before you go up and see the judge, and which means I had to wait by Kika. So when I go next to Kika, he's like, "So Walshy," he's like, "How you doing?" "No, seriously, how you doing?" I was like, "Not too great." He's like, "Walshy, I got something to ask you." He's like, "You know, I could really use you up there." I was like, "Up where, Kika?" "You know, up in the jury, I could really use you up there."
"You know, up there.
You know, code of silence and everything." And I was like, "I bet you could, Kika. I bet you could." And I didn't say anything else. And they called my name, and I walk up there, and they were like, "So, Mr. Walsh, is there any reason why you can't serve on this jury? Is there any reason, you know, any conflict of interest?" I was like, "Well, I know and grew up with the person who killed the man." I just admitted that I knew he was guilty, thus hopefully dismissing me. And they're like, "Anything else?" I was like, "Well, the arresting officer is my brother, Michael." They're like, "Is there anything else?" I was like, "Where's the kangaroo in this court?"
They probably got a little curious.
Yeah.
Like, how many connections to this fucking guy do you have?
Right.
And
then on the third one, they asked me, and they were like, "Is there anything else?" And I was like, "Well, you know, right before I got up here, your defendant said to me, I could really use you up there." And then... the judge just gaveled, and he's like, "Dismissed." And that's it. That's our story. Thanks a lot. We're the Walsh Bros. Have a great night, everybody.
The Narrators Podcast is recorded and produced by Ron Doyle.
The Narrators Podcast is brought to you by these amazing sponsors.
The great guys at Illegal Pete's and Greater Than Records, who in addition to providing rad burritos all over town, provide great local music and comedy.
Check out the appropriately named Sexy Pizza at either of their locations in Capitol Hill or Old South Pearl, or on their website, sexypizzaonline.com.
And finally, by the internet superheroes at Commerce Kitchen, who provide internet marketing solutions and search engine optimization for all your e-commerce needs. Check them out at commercekitchen.com.
For more information about the Narrators and to listen to past episodes, go to thenarratorspodcast.com. Thanks for listening.
Yeah.